Steve Spano, U.S. Air Force retired, is the General Manager, Defense and National Security for Amazon Web Services Global Public Sector. Retired from the Air Force in September 2011, Steve was formerly the Director of Communications, Headquarters Air Combat Command, Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, responsible for IT vision, policy guidance, and resource allocation supporting the command's warfighting mission. Prior to that, he served as the CJ-6 for Multinational Forces Iraq, where he was responsible for all IT policy, interoperability, and network operations supporting all joint and coalition forces. Please welcome Steve Spano to the Cloud Developers Summit and Expo.
Good morning. It is a pleasure to be with you today. I'm Italian, and it's early. I've had a couple cups of coffee, so I don't like standing behind a podium. I just feel a little bit more energized moving around. So it's exciting to be here to continue evangelizing about the evolution of cloud. And Mr. Hayden and his presentation actually set up the rest of today, and I think the rest of the keynotes and some of the panels. As Marty said, I've been with Amazon now for a little bit over 3 years, which is about half of the life of Amazon Web Services, which is just over 8 years. We just recently celebrated our birthday. So from the perspective of where we are with cloud computing, we are just scratching the surface of its potential, and it's exciting to see just in the last 3 years the fast pace and evolution of where we are. And I'd like to just share with you a few thoughts that of how Amazon thinks about cloud computing, where we are and its evolution, why customers are adopting cloud. And then as we get through the panel, really continue to dive deeper into some of the questions and that you guys may have as we progress through the program. This is the overview of a little bit about what I'm talking about. I like to look at cloud and its transformational value. So if you define transformation, to me, it's being relevant in ongoing change. How do organizations seek relevancy in its ongoing change? And so cloud offers the next disruption of IT services. And you'll see by the end, I hope that some of the examples and some of the discussions will show moving an organization such as DoD, having lived it for 28 years, is quite challenging. And it's a bureaucracy that was designed to be more slower and thoughtful. And I'd like to think of the axiom as you can think your way into new methods of acting, which is the classic DoD model of studying things and restudying them and recommissioning studies to analyze the studies before you really begin a set of movement toward it. And so historically, you'll see DoD tends to lag industry in adoption of commercial technologies, and cloud is really no different than anything else. The antecedent to that is you can act yourselves into new ways of thinking, which is basically take an approach to see the future and recognize that you want to get there, that you don't totally understand it, but you know that if you're moving in the right direction, that the specific path that you're on isn't necessarily that important yet, but you're moving towards something that's new and exciting. And we have customers, even within the federal agency, that have adopted the act yourself into new methods of thinking. And there's still some that go through the natural maturity of thinking themselves and studying and being sure. And there's nothing wrong with that. We're there to help both. And you'll see in some of the briefings material that I'll cover, the speed and agility are the fortes of what our customers are telling us the value of cloud really is. So why do I see cloud as transformational? If you look historically, the greatest innovations of mankind, whether it's Einstein, Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, relegated to the individual with a slide rule, deep understanding of sciences, in the basement, low capital expenditure, the greatest discoveries of mankind were done with low capital expense. And then with the advent of the Cray computer, the entry fee into that computing capacity was relegated to the few who could afford it. And so vast consortiums and venture capitalists began to dominate discoveries. And you saw the playing field begin to shift. And the rugged individual ideas and innovations began to give way to much broader consortiums that were throwing mass funding at the computing power that was needed to drive some of those discoveries. What cloud computing has done is, I think, re-leveled that playing field. Because if you have access to the same computing power at the same low cost as an individual in your basement with a great idea, as any of those consortiums do. And thus you're seeing in Silicon Valley with many of the startups, even the venture capitalists, who only had enough money to fund 10 great ideas, where most of those ideas required a lot of infrastructure, IT computing, that in many cases, if that venture failed, they had to figure out what are they going to do with this excess hardware and capacity, and thus they could only afford to fund perhaps 8, 10, 12, or whatever finite number of innovations. But when you don't have to invest millions upfront in capital expenditures for that infrastructure, and you can fail fast and move on to the next one, 10 ideas that you can fund now become 20 or 30 ideas that you can now fund. Because in the end, you're not stuck with data centers worth of capacity that you don't know what to do with because either the idea took off or it failed. That's what's leveling the playing field. That's what's exciting and fueling what I believe is this ongoing disruption or transformation. The second point about this transformation is organizational business models are beginning to change. Particularly from a government perspective, you have high volume, high margin hardware vendors who are now seeing a high volume, low margin business called cloud computing beginning to change that whole paradigm. And it's changing their entire approach to commoditizing IT and how they deliver classic hardware and other services that surround it. The large system integrators that have spent a lot of time providing staff augmentation, telling this and advising the staffs within government bureaucracies that perpetuate the status quo because they also make margin off of selling the hardware along with some of those services are also beginning to feel very disrupted. Because many of our customers are telling us we want to get out from underneath the large SIs that are charging us a lot of margin to just do traditional types of staff work. Now, there's a role for the SI, and I've challenged them in many forums to say, Amazon provides our services from the ground floor up to the hypervisor. Above the hypervisor is, to me, where the excitement occurs in cloud. That's where the innovation occurs. That's where the SIs, if they can retool and step back and look more long-term, can provide the greatest value to fueling this ongoing transformation. The channel is the primary driver to cloud adoption. But the business models of today need to be reworked to take advantage of that. And the challenges that many of them have are, I got my quarterly profits to Wall Street, or I can retool to look toward the future, and down the road somewhere will be the rainbow with the gold sitting at it. And it's a tough business decision. That's why it's driving different business models and different ways of thought. And we see very many of them that will sort of hover around and they're watching what's happening, and they're trying to figure out, is this a buzzword? Is cloud here to stay? Is it not? Some will dive in and make a pass and go, how much is the investment that I have to make in training some of my people? And some take that investment and begin, and we've got a number of partners that have done that. And others who have sort of taken that pass and they look short-sighted at the quarterly bottom lines and they're not seeing the instant return on that investment. And so I will tell you, the difference between leading the revolution or waiting until the revolution becomes a movement is the difference between differentiating yourself and driving change and finding your way and discovering new and exciting ways about your organization and yourselves and your way of thinking, or let's wait and see and be a part of the movement where you're standing shoulder to shoulder in a mass of people and you can't differentiate yourself, or it's so much harder to differentiate the value that you then provide. So do you want to be a part of the revolution or do you want to wait and be a part of the movement? Neither is wrong. It's all based upon your assessment of risk to your organizations. We work with both. My sense is being a part of the revolution provides far greater rewards than waiting until the movement occurs, and I have several examples I can share on the panel from my Air Force days to prove that. New organizational constructs we're seeing spring up. Flatter, more nimble organizations that are taking advantage of crowdsourcing and technologies to make decisions faster, to me, is really the exciting part. Coming from the Department of Defense, which is a classic hierarchy of chain of command, you're now seeing cloud even relooking at the distributed nature of how content and information is being acted upon. The White House now can see the air battle over Syria. Great situational awareness, but it's also driving interesting demands of, should the White House be picking the targets, or should they be still deferring to the on-scene commander? So it's bringing interesting lexicons of thought and decision-making processes. But to those industries and businesses, it's pretty exciting to see how classic organizations are becoming flatter, more distributed, more cross-functional. And I talked about the commoditization of IT, and cloud is a high-volume, low-margin business. And you have classic spending lines within the federal government where IT is procured in different program elements and budgets, and your classic utilities of power and electricity are paid differently. There will be a day, I can't predict when that'll all merge. And you will pay for IT the same way you pay for your electricity. And it'll be blended in different ways in the billing processes for how governments think. We're a long way from there. And then undergirding it all is the speed, agility, and the innovation, which I'll talk about coming up. I think it's important to talk a little bit about the definition of cloud, what it is and what it isn't. We go by the standard NIST definition, but on any given day, you can talk to any given vendor and any given RFP that calls for cloud, you will see a vendor switch from, I am a hosting platform, to that same platform being cloud. They just changed the sign. We call them cloud washers. And I think that that confuses a lot of the people who are maturing and they're thinking in evolution. It confuses the masses of acquisition and contracting officials, because making a decision on an acquisition that is seeking true cloud in its definition of on-demand, pay for what you go, auto-scaling, broad network access versus a hosting platform that can rent you some form of computing or storage space. And I would just say beware of the cloud washers, because they can convolute the revolution as we begin to move forward. I love this quote because it's the natural psychology of how IT is traditionally adopted and embraced. And I speak on behalf mainly of my experiences within DOD, but I bet they are very much the same across federal government and even in some organizations. Anytime there's a challenge to the status quo and you're in the midst of a transformation, this natural psychology plays out. We recognize it, we see it, even as organizations begin to cycle through it, you still start to see the dramatic changes from "we'll never do this" to what you see here. Some of the biggest events that have occurred have been in the backdrop running on Amazon Web Services and in cloud. And even some of those same organizations that see this and don't even recognize it are still in some various phase of that. And there's not a point in time where you say, hey, we have arrived, it's here. It's an evolution because you're always going to deal, I think, with some of that. In my experience, particularly within DOD, whether it's voice over IP technology, whether it's the switch from analog private branch exchanges to digital, whether it's voicemail to BlackBerries when they were first introduced. It's the natural psychology of those, if you follow the money, who stand to lose the most are the ones that perpetuate this psychology and thinking. That begins to trumpet as we begin to tell that story. And that, within the federal government, where we have over 800 plus agencies now leveraging AWS. Our education vertical is the fastest growing within the public sector. We're seeing federal government begin to expand very rapidly, and other agencies are still at other maturity states that we're continuing to work. And it's a day-to-day investment in the challenge of continually educating and pushing transformation in large bureaucracies that aren't used to moving as fast as others, particularly within the commercial sector. I told you the channel is where cloud comes alive on top of our platform. The channel's what delivers those services. This isn't a we and a they, even though there are challenges within some of the system integrators and how their models are beginning to morph and adapt. But that partner ecosystem is beginning to grow. If I showed this slide 2 years ago, you'd have probably seen maybe a fraction of the amount of icons and logos that are on there. And it's only getting better. So why are organizations choosing to adopt cloud and AWS? I talked about agility. When you have no capital expenditure and you can spin up a server in literally minutes, compared to, from a government perspective, the amount of time it takes to order, go through the acquisition, competitively bid even the smallest server, to finding a space in the data center, to finding and ensuring that the power in the data center can support it, to the system administration, and so on and so forth. The life cycle of a server is, on average, if you add compliance, a 6 to 9 month venture. Compared to, once you get the compliance, you can spin up a server literally in minutes, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of use cases of the hundreds of thousands of customers that we have in 190 different countries that testify to the agility and the speed. And it doesn't just come from one region or one data center. It's the scale that allows the power of AWS to come alive. We've got 10 regions around the world. One of them is GovCloud, which is an ITAR compliant region. What you don't see up here is an 11th region, which is for a very sensitive national security customer in their mission set, an entire community. the scale allows us to continue to reduce pricing and to offer new services and to invest in some of the most important parts of your business. Every imaginable use case to date in just over 8 years. That's exciting. You're not just seeing developers adopting cloud and AWS. You're not just seeing Silicon Valley startups. You're beginning to see some of the largest companies begin to put the future stake of their business on AWS. Platform breadth. It isn't about, do we just offer 20 plus different versions or varieties of EC2 for compute or Glacier for cold storage and S3. It's adding rich services across the entire stack that allow you to plan, to build, to deploy, and to manage your applications in the cloud on AWS. And continually innovating to provide features and new services at a blistering pace. Where the traditional companies will spend years on the next iteration of their software or their hardware, we pride ourselves on a foundation and DNA of continuous innovation and features of our services, as well as offering new services for analytics, storage, and a variety of other capabilities. The cost savings and flexibility, you're not locked in. There is no vendor lock-in, as there has been in traditional on-prem infrastructure and business models. Over 40 price reductions, various types of ways to access our services, on-demand reserve instances, or you can compete in the open market for spot instances, and then many different forms of pricing. We work across the spectrum to give you flexibility and agility. And undergirding it all is our number one priority, which is security. Our model is built on a shared security model. We provide you a secure virtual machine at the hypervisor. However, how you implement on top of AWS, how you implement firewalls, how you manage access, identity, and what you do to control and manage your applications creates the natural symmetry of the best of what AWS provides, but the essential control that most organizations want to be able to ensure security is managed. The same compliance regime that goes in thinking that goes into on-prem goes into cloud. And for some reason, over time, and frankly, even when I was on active duty, I often thought that security was used as a smokescreen for what really is a lack of trust and control. Is I'm giving something up. I can't hug my server, and thus it's not secure. And I look at the risk model, particularly within certain verticals of the federal government, the scope and complexity of the networks is increasing. The expectation, the demands, the service level agreements from a warfighter all the way through the federal government are on this trajectory. Resources, training, all the things that go in to managing that are going down this way. And that gap is the risk that organizations are incurring. And believing that that gap of risk is mitigated by the fact that it's on-prem is a false sense of security in my mind, and I always felt that when I was on active duty speaking in uniform. When you have younger and younger airmen, NCOs, officers that are managing far more complex networks that are attacked on a constant basis, you're incurring risk. And when you are cutting the force, as the military has been under sequestration, it has to come from somewhere, and it's often peanut butter spread. That incurs risk. And so most of our customers will tell us that, you know, that risk has been mitigated by moving to the cloud. Frankly, all of our customers tell us that security moving into AWS is far better than the traditional path of absorbing the cuts in manpower and the training that they're not getting. And there's a variety of reasons for that we can talk on the panel. But the compliance regimes are exciting. We recently received a level 3 through 5 provisional authorization from DISA. It's the first provisional authorization at that level, which is the highest sensitivity for unclassified data that exists today. FedRAMP, of course, as you know, is the baseline for all federal agencies of the security controls that they could all agree on. DoD felt that for sensitive data at levels 3 through 5, they needed additional control, so they published their cloud security model. There are probably about 45, at last count, additional controls to achieve a level 3 through 5 provisional authorization. And so they raised the bar extremely high, being very conservative to issue the very first of these provisional authorizations. And we're excited to feel that we cleared that bar. And in clearing that bar, I think we helped pioneer for the rest of the cloud providers within industry that will continually allow DISA to assess their model and begin to recognize which controls are really needed, which ones need to be revised and rewritten, which ones are still kind of rooted in analog thinking, and which ones are rooted in the digital age. But being a pioneer, it took a lot of work. We're excited about it, and we're looking forward to now moving those sensitive workloads to prove both the value, the speed, and the agility of cloud in AWS. And I'll talk more about this on the panel with a little bit more examples in terms of segueing. But it goes to the maturity of where the customer set is within the federal government. And it goes back to that slide on the psychology of how our organizations getting started. From test and dev to migrating mission applications or to production to mission applications and eventually all in. We got plenty of examples of all in. And all along the path, even within DoD, you see some that are probably a little further along into the production. Some are moving to mission applications. But by and large, I would say that DoD is probably in the phase one as an entity in an organization. And that's okay. They are just getting started, thinking through this, as is their culture, and looking toward the future of how commercial cloud is integrated into their overall mission. This wasn't the case a couple years ago. Now we're starting to see. It's a key indicator that we're beginning to turn the corner as companies and organizations within the federal government begin to ask not, you know, what can't go to the cloud. It's And then, of course, from the map of where we are within the spectrum of the Gartner Magic Quadrant as one of the leading providers, we're excited about it. We don't rest on our laurels. So I'll end with one quick story that I think and hope will pull us all together of the reasons why we believe cloud is transformational, as well as why we're seeing this movement toward AWS. And it's a story on active duty from my time in Iraq. I got there in 2008, and it was in the middle of the surge. And the first slide in the battle update briefing that was presented was from Intel, intelligence assessment and briefing of what happened the day before. And it was a chart of casualties. And during that surge, the chart was going like this every day. And I kept a notebook of every the number of casualties that the Intel briefing started off with. Sir, here's your morning update. Last night, there were 38 casualties, 20 of them civilian, 5 of them military. And then we go directly into the rest of the briefing. As the surge began to play out, that chart started to go this way. And then they would go around to each of the sectors around the Baghdad area that we were moving and clearing out with the surge strategy. One of those sectors was called Sadr City. And it was a place that we spent a lot of time in those updates that was extremely, extremely volatile. And it was the sector that you could see we were, you know, from my perspective, we were waiting for the right strategic time to figure out when we were going in. During my time in Iraq, I ran into probably a half a dozen college graduates that I hadn't seen in 25 or 26 years. One of them is a guy named Frank, Lieutenant Colonel Army, on his fourth 15-month deployment as a reservist, He had been there during the early stages when it was really ugly and got bad, went home, redeployed. He was on his fourth deployment. And we would get together whenever he came back from the field, have dinner, smoke a cigar on top of Saddam's palace, and talk about life, college, family. And it was just a great solace and a great time to reconnect in a crazy place. And I can remember when the decision was made to go into Sadr City, I didn't get a second thought as to who was going to be leading that battle and that campaign until I got an email from my buddy Frank's brother, who I also went to college with, who said they had just gotten a call that Frankie had gotten hurt. And then it connected on me that he was the one that was there in Sadr City. It turned out that he got stuck in the middle of a mortar attack where 6 of them came raining down on top of him. There's a classified video of it. And it's amazing when you watch the video how anybody could have survived it. He said, if I had a catcher's mitt, I literally could have caught some of the mortars that came down. He said, it dropped me into a hole at the base of a T-wall. Some private picked me up and said, hey, are you okay? And he goes, yeah, I think so. And the next thing he knows, he was in the infirmary. He had a class 5 concussion. 3 days later, he was back in Sadr City leading his troops. I believe it was, he got a Purple Heart, 2nd Bronze Star. Just a great story of a citizen soldier who I believe is a hero. So what does that have to do with AWS? So fast forward now, 2011, I retire, start with Amazon Web Services. We get a phone call from an officer at one of the research labs within DOD. And he's a researcher. And he says, hey, I've got this model I want to run to analyze imagery, battlefield imagery. And I can't afford a server. I don't know where I'm going to put it. And I need a little bit of help. I only need to do this, run this model for perhaps a week or so to then get the data to write my study. So we led him to Amazon Web Services. In 20 minutes, he spun up a server. He loaded his model. He ran a report, said he ran more analysis than he ever could have in the 6 to 9 months it would have taken him to buy a server, to install a server, to get the compliance, to find a data center, find an administrator. His report was done in 3 weeks. And the notional imagery that he was using in his analysis was imagery from Sadr City. And so, while not enough and in time to potentially have helped my buddy Frank, the speed, the agility of what that guy did in his research, if you think forward to the other Franks that it could save or help or provide intelligence, that's the power of what cloud can do for missions of the most sensitive nature and in ways that nobody could have ever thought could have been valuable and personal. And oh, by the way, he said, I tried to use a government impact card, but it was too cumbersome, so I put it on my own personal credit card. And he said the 59 hours or so that I ran my model cost me only $40. He said I was probably looking at a bill of somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 in 6 to 9 months. So that's the value. That's why I believe we're in the midst of a transformation and a disruption. And to me, that's exciting. Thank you very much.